Heavenly Father, this is your word, and we are your people. Please bless your word to your people today. Amen. You know, I love the story of the young seminary student who was enrolled in his first preaching class. And he got nervous when he heard he'd have to stand up in front of the entire class and preach his first sermon. But when the day came, all the students were there, and he was called up to the pulpit, and he stood there for a minute looking at them, and they were all looking back at him. And finally he said, "Do you know what I'm going to say?" And they all shook their heads. "No, we don't know what you're going to say." "Well, neither do I," he said. "Let's all stand for the benediction." Well, his preaching professor was a little miffed and said to him afterward, "Well, look, if you want to pass this course, you have to preach a sermon. So next week I'm calling you up again and you'll have another chance." Well, the next week comes around and all the students are seated there again, and he's called up to the pulpit, and he stood there for a minute looking out at all the faces looking back at him, and finally he said, "Do you know what I'm going to say?" Half of them shook their heads, "No, we don't know what you're going to say." And the other half rolled their eyes and said, "Yes, we know what you're going to say." So he says, "Well then, let those who know tell those who don't. Let's all stand for the benediction." So afterward, his professor was a little upset and took him aside and said, "Look, I'm giving you one more chance here, and otherwise you're going to fail this course." So the next week comes around, and once again all the students are seated there, and he's called up to the pulpit and stood there for a minute looking back at all the faces looking at him, and finally he says, "Do you know what I'm going to say?" They all nodded their heads, "Yes, we know what you're going to say." "Well then, I don't have to tell you. Let's all stand for the benediction." You know, we all experience some significant failures in life. One of my own early failures was in grade 6 when everyone in my class had to prepare a 5-minute oratorical speech and deliver it to the whole assembly without using any notes. You had to memorize it. And others stood up and seemed to do fine. And when my turn came, I got up there, it was okay, but about 2 minutes in, I blanked out. Couldn't remember a thing, and stood there embarrassed, unable to continue. And so I reached into my back pocket and pulled out my written speech, and which I wasn't supposed to have with me, and read the rest of the speech from my manuscript. So I not only failed to get a good mark, but developed a fear of public speaking ever since. That's maybe why I still use notes today. Well, a few years later, after high school, I took a summer job as a deckhand with a friend on a commercial troller off the West Coast, and I thought it would be the great fishing adventure, but I failed miserably. Bad weather, seasickness, difficult working conditions just turned that adventure into drudgery, and halfway through the summer, I bought a float plane ticket and flew back home, leaving my friend without a deckhand. Not my finest moment. You know, we all fail at things that are maybe not that important, but when we fail at something that really matters, like our life's work, our marriage, or parenting, or at some issue of integrity, that sense of failure often won't go away. You can feel tainted by it like you'll never be free of it. These kind of failures can begin to kind of haunt your spirit. You may even begin telling yourself, "Well, I'm not worthy, I'm such a failure, I'm just a loser. If only I had a do-over, if only I had another chance." You know, some of God's best people struggled with stuff like this. People like Moses, people like Jacob, people like David and Jonah, I mean, they all experienced significant failures in their life. And then there's some, like Simon Peter here, who failed spectacularly, who struggled with his failure so deeply that he went off mission and forgot his divine calling, his God-given calling. And it was because in his failure, he underestimated God's love and the Lord's willingness to forgive and to offer him another chance. So we see Peter here in conversation with the risen Jesus at the end of John's gospel. And he's a man who had failed his best friend, having denied even knowing his master at that crucial moment after Jesus was arrested. And he was sure, I think, that that failure had put him beyond the reach of God's grace, though he turned out to be wonderfully wrong about that. And so Simon Peter's story is a story for anyone who has ever been broken by failure. The story of a man who once threw away the chance of a lifetime, but it's also the story of the God of the second chance. You know, ever since that night of Jesus' arrest, his crucifixion the next day, and, you know, his disciples had had a pretty rough ride. Unexpectedly losing their master, then hiding behind locked doors in fear of their lives, and then hearing that Jesus had risen and being overwhelmed with amazement. But when Jesus shows up, it's kind of weird. Jesus materializes and disappears. He materializes and disappears and shows them his wounds. He eats with them, and then he's gone again. And after a few days, some of those disciples are saying, well, we didn't think it was going to turn out quite like this. We can't really get a handle on it. Why don't we just go back to life as it used to be? Something we understand, something we can control. And so with heavy hearts, they go back to Galilee. And there by that familiar lake that Peter knows so well, he says to the others, I'm going fishing. Well, as Peter wrestles with his feelings of failure here, he decides to do something that might remind him of his past successes. I mean, he'd been an expert fisherman, and so he's going to go back to what he knows best, to what he feels good about. And you know, sometimes when we experience failure or self-doubt, we tend to gravitate to the old familiar things that we feel competent in. And we use them to try and satisfy our sense of self-worth. Well, Peter thinks that these old patterns of success will somehow relieve the pain of his failure. But those patterns will never meet the needs of his heart. Nevertheless, that evening, Peter and John and five other disciples get into a boat and they go back to fishing. And for them to do that means that they're going off mission. They're going off their calling as fishers of men. Their action was actually threatening the very work that Jesus had called them to 3 years before. In fact, if they had returned to fishing for only fish, you and I would not be sitting here today, right? So in their confusion, they're going off mission. They're going off of their divine calling here. And I'm not really sure I blame them. I think I'd be pretty discouraged too. And so it's their first day here, their renewed business venture. And that night they go out and they fished all night and they caught zero, zip, nada, nothing. You know, their kind of work, their fishing was hard work too. But they were experienced fishermen here, and yet every time they drew in the net, it was empty. Now they're really discouraged. You know, if you bail out on Jesus and you go off mission because you think there's something better out there, you'll end up fishing all night and catching nothing. Well, by 6 a.m. the next morning, Peter and his friends are pretty tired, they're frustrated, they're discouraged. And to make matters worse, there's some guy standing on the shore there shouting, as Kathy said, got any fish? They don't yet realize that it's Jesus. But his question does have a bit of a sting to it, you know. And I think Jesus asked that question to see if they would acknowledge their failure. And you know, an amazing thing happens. A group of fishermen actually admit that they've caught nothing. They don't even try to talk about the one that got away. But Jesus always has a way of asking provocative questions, questions that expose the truth. And so Jesus starts this encounter on the seashore here with a question and by getting the answer that he's been waiting to hear, which was their admission of failure. No, we haven't caught a thing. And the point is, you can't really learn anything from your failure until you admit your failure, right? So put yourself in the disciples' place here. This guy on the shore who they don't yet realize is Jesus yells over to them, "Why do you guys throw your net on the other side?" They're thinking, "Who is this bozo on the beach? You know, what does he know?" And maybe just to prove the futility of it all, they throw their net off the right side of the boat. And we know what happened. I mean, it was the catch of the century. And that was so full, they couldn't even pull it in. And of course, that's when they realize who it is there on the shore. It's also when Peter loses his mind, he puts on his coat and jumps into the sea. Apparently, Peter preferred fishing in his underwear. But he thought he better get dressed if he's going to go meet the risen Jesus. Maybe he thought he'd try walking on water again, but you know, he even failed at that once as well. But basically, Peter was overcome here with emotion. And maybe because he's remembering something. He's remembering the first time he met Jesus after fishing all night and catching nothing. You remember that time in Luke chapter 5? Jesus met Peter, got into his boat, and told him to go out and let down the nets. And that time they caught so many fish that the nets began to break. And suddenly, just overwhelmed with amazement, Peter there says to Jesus, "Go away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man." And Jesus said, in effect, "I know about all that, but I'm giving you another chance. From now on, you're going to fish for people." And that was to be Peter's mission, to be a fisher of men. But now, almost 3 years later, the reason Peter jumped out of the boat and waded or swam to Jesus is because Jesus planned that this second fishing miracle, this second miraculous catch here, would mentally take Peter back to that moment of his calling. And so he'd remember that moment there when Christ was so compellingly real to him, so totally worth everything to him, that he'd even abandoned his fishing business to follow him. Well, this second miracle not only put fish in the net, but it kept fish out of the net all night long, right? In order to remind Peter of his calling. And as if there's some of us Christians, you know, who are a little discouraged with the Christian life not turning out the way we thought it would, we need to maybe go back to the moment of our calling, to our first encounter with Christ in our life. And remember when Jesus was so compelling and so worthy, and his sacrifice was so impactful, and his truth was so freeing, that you said to him, "I'm going to follow him." Sometimes after failures and disappointments and distractions, we need to think back to what got us started with Jesus in the first place. And we need to think about why things might have changed. Has Jesus changed? Have you changed? Have you got off course? Well, when Peter and the other disciples land on the shore there with a net full of fish, the risen Jesus says to them, "Come and have breakfast." And they see there a charcoal fire with fish laid out on it and some bread. And where did that come from? Well, I think Jesus is making a point here. And he's just kind of saying, "You guys thought you had to go off mission to meet your needs. But look, I provide everything you need." And you know, when we stay on mission and we're faithful to our calling, he will provide for us abundantly. We just have to trust him. So Jesus is setting the stage here to search Peter's heart. So he'll stop trusting in his own strength and know the all-sufficiency of Jesus Christ. And also find release from his shame and a renewed purpose in life. So Jesus has a fire there on the beach, and in verse 9 it specifically says it was a charcoal fire. And that word charcoal is used only twice in the New Testament, here and in John 18, verse 18, which is when, after Jesus' arrest, Peter's waiting there in the high priest's courtyard in Jerusalem, warming himself by a charcoal fire. It's the very scene of his great failure here, where three times out of fear he denied even knowing his Lord. And so now Peter sees this charcoal fire on the beach. He probably smells the aroma of the smoke, and you know how aromas can sometimes bring back certain memories. I think what Peter saw and smelled immediately reminded him of how a short time before, beside a charcoal fire, he had denied his Lord. So if he's now going to be with Jesus, he's going to have to face the truth about who he is and what he's done. And if we're going to experience a second chance from the Lord ourselves, we need to acknowledge the truth about our own failures. Peter had had many failures along the way, but now he's remembering this greatest failure of his life. And sometimes we too may have failures that seem irredeemable, that seem unforgivable. But there by this fire, Peter's remembering how he had failed his God and three times denied even knowing it. So picture for a moment that charcoal fire as the place of your own failures, your moments of backsliding or rebellion or faithlessness. And picture Jesus meeting you in that place and looking you in the eye, but not to condemn you, but to nourish you with love and forgiveness, to bring healing and restoration and a renewed purpose to your life. So Jesus met Peter there at the place of his failure in order to turn his failure upside down. Just as he turned that zero catch of fish into a catch with more fish than a net could hold. And it says, by that charcoal fire, Jesus took bread and he gave it to them. And he did the same with the fish, bread and fish. What I think Jesus is doing here is he's taking two strands from Peter's past, the miracle of the loaves and the failure of the fish, and he's weaving them together into Peter's present. He's feeding Peter from the place of his failure to show that his failure doesn't disqualify him. And Jesus wants to go to our places of failure as well. And he's waiting for you there, not to give you a lecture, but to share with you the bread of life and meet with you in the places where you've been broken. Well, after the breakfast, Jesus takes Peter aside. Maybe they go for a little walk down the beach. And for the first time since Peter's triple denial here, he and Jesus are together, one-on-one. And Peter's maybe feeling a bit like a convict here, waiting for the verdict of the court. But then he hears another question. A question that would both wound his heart, but also heal and restore him. Peter, do you love me? And Jesus questions Peter with that two more times. But he doesn't ask Peter, Peter, are you sorry for what you've done? Or, Peter, do you promise never to fail me again? Will you try harder from now on? No. He simply asks, do you love me? He doesn't quiz Peter about the failures of his past, but about his decision in the present. What will you do? Do you love me? Jesus had already resolved Peter's past, but Peter needs this threefold confrontation here to make that clear to him. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And three times Peter responds, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And three times Jesus says, then feed my sheep. You know, some people point out the fact that the two different Greek words are used here for the word love and two different Greek words are used for the word sheep. And they try to derive some special meaning out of those variations. But most New Testament scholars agree that John, the writer, was just using some stylistic variation here to keep from repeating the same words over and over. And so the significance of the repetition is not in the synonyms, but in the number of times the question is repeated. Three times. Three times Peter stood by that fire in Jerusalem and denied his Lord. And now three times he stands by this fire on the beach and professes his love. And three times Jesus says, then feed my sheep. He's saying, Peter, I want you to guard and guide and nurture this little flock that means all the world to me. So Peter, get back in the game. If you care about what I care about, that's how I'll know that you love me. Feed my sheep. As I shared with some others recently, those three words, feed my sheep, have been very significant to me personally, because God used those same three words to call me back to himself many years ago and also to eventually call me into ministry. So Peter here is being graciously reinstated, recalled into service here. No questions asked except, do you love me? And I think Jesus is saying to all of us here who failed God in some way, whatever it is we've done, he's saying, just get back in the game. The value of the gifts and the calling that I've given you, and devote yourself to the flock. Help feed the sheep because you're needed. Each and every one of us is needed. In fact, just a few weeks further on from this meeting with Jesus on the beach, Peter would be filled with the Holy Spirit on that life-changing day of Pentecost. God's power would then enable him to do things he could never do in his own strength and reach people he could never have reached. But he had to go through this little process first. You know, the Bible is actually full of examples of God longing to give second chances even after the worst of failures. And Jesus can take our failures and turn them into victories. I think if God waited for only perfect people to get involved, he'd still be doing it all himself, right? So really, the church is a place for people who need do-overs. And that's what God does. He's a loving Father who will give us another chance. In Psalm 103, in verse 13, it says, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those who fear him. We have a very compassionate God. You know, when my children were small, we used to play a game where we'd say, I don't love you this much, I don't love you this much, I love you this much, and we'd spread our hands out wide. But sometimes, you know, our children have a way of testing our love, right? One time I was painting the house, and they got into the paint and the brushes, and they painted everything in sight, the brick wall, the tree trunks, the sidewalk, all splattered and smeared with house paint. When they saw my face afterwards, they knew that they had sinned, and they knew that the wages of sin is death. But, you know, they looked at me with those big sad eyes, and then I remembered telling them about, I love you this much. And, yeah, I was upset, but how could I punish them? Maybe someday they would become great artists. And so I just said, okay, let's put this stuff away. And I forgave them, of course, and still love them just as much. But there was some damage that still had to be dealt with. They weren't able to remove that paint themselves. Somebody, me, had to do it for them, and it wasn't easy. So forgiveness is more than just words. There's a cost to it. There's a cost to forgiving people. There's a cost to forgiveness. Someone has to pay. Someone has to remove the stain. And you know, that's exactly what took place at the cross for you and me. An unpayable debt was paid, and the stain was removed. So we can get another chance. So we can have a fresh start. You know, God has shown us his love in many, many ways, but when he sent Jesus to the cross, he was saying, I don't just love you this much, I love you this much. And the Son of God literally stretched out his hands on that cross, saying, now you can be freed from the power of every regret, because every sin has been paid for. And I'm giving you another chance if you will receive it. Well, in the final verses here, Jesus says that to Peter too, that one day he will stretch out his hands. And it meant for Peter that following Jesus would eventually lead him to a martyr's death, stretching out his own hands on the crossbeam of a cross, as though he's saying back to God, I love you this much. Well, finally, in verses 20 to 22, it says that when Peter looked back and he saw the disciple John following them, he said, Lord, what about him? And Jesus said, well, even if he's still alive, when I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. And you know, God calls each one of us to glorify him by following him in whatever way he happens to lead us, which may be something quite different from that of someone else. We all have different paths. But he just wants us to put away our guilt, our misgivings, and our doubts, and know that our sins and failures can be forgiven. And that's possible because he is the God of the do-over. He's the Lord of the second chance. So in closing, I want to leave you with a question. When Jesus looks into your heart, does he see there an open door? Or does he just see a little sign that says, gone fishing?